So this is your chance. If you want to ask any questions or bring something up or report a little bit how it's going with the meditations at home, this is your chance to do that before we start. People are still coming in. Yeah.
I'll start with a simple one. We talked a lot about physical discomfort and working through it last week. And I can see that when it's certain things, but what I realized was I had a heavy bracelet watch on, and when I had it down like this, as it was digging into me for the longest time. If it's something that you know you can correct and be free of it, can you, should you do that during the meditation or still work through it?
Do you hear the question?
No.
Okay, I'll give it. Is it too loud or is it just right? Or?
It's okay.
Just right? Because it's a little bit loud for me, but I'll live with it. I feel like I'm listening to myself.
A little echo.
Should we try turning it down a little bit?
A little echo.
A little bit down, maybe. And can you hear me still? That's a little bit more natural for me. So I only hear myself from here now, rather than this, you know. Okay, so the question is about physical discomfort while you're meditating. And if you can easily adjust for it, should you sit with the pain until the end of the session, or should you change for it? And she said that she had some heavy watch or something that was digging in to her wrist and causing discomfort. And that's really your call, whether you do that. So rather than giving you a yes or no answer, I'll give you the kind of the principle behind it. Is that the basic idea is that if you think it's useful to continue sitting with the discomfort, then please do. But if you feel it's not useful anymore, then don't. But useful is a kind of a, you know, a little bit delicate thing, because sometimes we don't like something and it's still useful. So it's simply the fact we don't like it, you know, is that not necessarily the same thing as it's useful. So what is useful is if you feel like you're learning how to develop your mindfulness, how you're learning how to develop your equanimity, your ability to be present for things that are even difficult without struggling with them or hating them or doing anything, then, and you're not damaging yourself, then I think it's fine to sit there and continue. And I've sat with a lot of physical discomfort, and it was part of the practice. I included it. And some of that was very valuable for me. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about, because you have a kind of a laboratory situation. You're sitting this way, and so sitting in meditation, and you can see aspects of yourself under duress that you wouldn't have be able to see out in normal life when things are so busy and you have to make decisions and all that. So there's an opportunity here in this laboratory to see yourself in a way that you couldn't otherwise. So sometimes it's very valuable to have discomfort in meditation, because you see aspects of yourself and how you tend to habitually respond and react and blame and attack and get afraid or all the different things that happen. And so you could see that really well in this laboratory situation, so you can learn maybe to recognize it more in normal life and not to be the slave of it in normal life, how to be, have the upper hand, or how to be a little bit free of that tendency, because you see it so well. Maybe as I said earlier, Buddhist practice aims at freedom. And if you're only free when you're comfortable, you're not really free. So part of the task of meditation is to learn how to be free when you're uncomfortable too, when something's happening that you don't like. The habitual way many of us have of reacting is running away from what we don't like or changing it, demanding something be different. But can you find a peace with things not being the way you like? So if that process of doing that, if you're engaged in that process and you find it useful, you feel like you're making headways or you're learning or you're up for the challenge, then maybe stay with the discomfort. But if you feel it's not useful and it's a drag and it's discouraging you and you feel like, then change. Please. Is that helpful? If you have any suspicion that you're damaging yourself through the discomfort, then, of course, change your posture right away. In a Zen circle sometimes, there was a period of time when I was a Zen student where a lot of the other Zen students around me were going in for knee surgery. And they were sitting in, half lotus, like this, or full lotus for long periods of time. And they had a tremendous amount of pain, but they just were to tough it out. And because Zen practice is kind of, samurai spirit. And what the Zen practice didn't have was a careful mindfulness to distinguish between pain that's okay to have and pain which is damaging. And so they just toughed it out and ended up damaging their knees. And it's pretty rare in this practice that we do the people damage themselves through the because we're paying attention. And if you pay careful attention, you'll notice the difference between that. There tends to be signals you get that this is damaging. Other questions or comments or reports? It'd be nice to hear a little bit how it's been. Yeah.
When I first started this, it's only been a really short time, you know, how the mind just kind of takes off in its own little world. Well, now what I notice, because I've been doing this every day, is that if you, I like the counting. I love to count. So that was really great to hear that I could count. But what I notice now is that instead of my mind taking off into this whole other world, I get thoughts that interrupt my concentration, but they're only for a minute.
Uh-huh.
And it's different. So like I'm being interrupted all the time, but it's not like I'm taking off for a long time and then realizing I'm gone.
Great.
So that's like that's a change, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I'm making progress. I think it's nice. So she said that it used to be she would drift off for long periods of time in meditation, but now that she's getting more connected to the breath and able to concentrate on the breath more, she finds her thoughts still arise, but they arise kind of more momentary-like.
Yeah, they seem like they're always keep coming, but they're only for a minute. I don't get lost.
Right. So she has the presence of mind now to catch notice that you're thinking and to come back. So it used to be that the gap before you woke up was a long one. And now the gap is getting shorter and shorter. And with time, the gap will get shorter and shorter and shorter. And one of the amazing things around thoughts, if you're very present, concentratedly present in the moment, you can watch the impulse to have a thought arise. You can notice that impulse, you can let go of it, and you'll never know what that thought was going to be. Because there's often a little indication in the mind, kind of like a little sense of pressure or tension, a little something, a little impulse that's like the mind is getting ready to have a thought or, you know, heralding a thought or something. And you can be aware of that before you think, before the thought happens. There's a lot of fun things in meditation. Yes?
I have a friend who wanted me to ask you. He has a very bad back. It's very hard for him to sit in meditation. I wonder what good alternative posture is.
It's fine to sit with a chair with a backrest if you need that for a reason. You can also do meditation lying down. And chances are, some point during the day, the next hour and a half, if you turn around behind you, you'll probably see someone laying down in meditation. Because Andre, who's sitting up there, she's done a lot of meditation practice on her back because of back injury. And she's quite, you know, she's one of our senior students here. So she's the living proof that you can have great meditation laying on your back. Right? Well, no fall asleep. Is that a problem for you at all? No. I asked you about falling asleep. How come?
It's a specific posture. I use my arm up like this so that if I start to drift, it'll wake me up.
Now, having seen that, don't everyone rush home and say, well, you know, if I can meditate that way, great.
You know, it does take a dedication of intention to say.
Yeah.
You know, I also have really bad neck and back injuries, and what I found is that this position with the pillow doesn't put the pressure on the back. It's just something about this way of sitting that just doesn't hurt in that position.
This is better than cross-legged for sure.
Yeah. So there's a variety of ways to sit. You know that if someone has a lot of physical problems in sitting, having someone like a teacher look at your posture, they can make suggestions sometimes they can make a difference. So yeah, last one, then we'll.
Do you have any comment on? Let's say the value of the benefit of one longer meditation as opposed to, let's say, two briefer ones, let's say two 15-minute ones, or one 30-minute, if sometimes given the way my day goes, I only have a 15-minute increment free, something like that.
Well, you remember you were here last week when I told you the story about two monks asking the abbot if they could smoke in the monastery. It's kind of like that. It's fine to, you know, any meditation you do is great.
And in terms of, do you have a thought as to something can be juggled? Is it optimal, particularly one way, or do you just think it's a matter of experience?
Well, I would tend towards giving a generic answer, which is that it's better to sit for half an hour rather than 15 minutes, because then you have a chance to kind of get into it more, and some of the surface chatter can quiet down, and some of this, you can, and after 15-20 minutes you can kind of really get more concentrated or stiller, and then go further with that stillness. So that's kind of, you know, but it really depends on an individual, and the spirit of doing this practice is one of trial and error. So rather than getting a generic answer from some teacher who thinks he knows what he's talking about, you try it out both ways and see what helps you the most. And I can well imagine that for some people, it can be quite powerful for some period of time to do 2 15-minute periods in different parts of the day and have that as touchstone through the day. Or even 5-minute sittings, you know, 6 times a day. Just as a touchstone and kind of wake you up and kind of reconnect or kind of wake up. And it might be more useful for a period of time than sitting 1 30-minute session. So it really, you know, so there's all kinds of ways in which this can go and different phases of your practice and all that. And the spirit really is trial and error. So you might try both ways and then see which is most useful and beneficial for you. Okay.
Are you doing that, or can you do that? My eyes are closed, so I don't know if you are doing that.
Sorry?
Is that something you will do? I
very seldom go around and change and adjust people's posture here. Sometimes I do a day-long meditation retreat on mindfulness of the body, just the body. And then in that one, sometimes I go around and do everybody's posture. But otherwise, it's on by request. So at the end of a sitting, end of one of these sessions, evenings, if you stay behind and ask me to look at your posture, I'll be happy to look at it that way. For anybody, unless there's too many of you, any one evening. So, welcome to our third week. And we've covered mindfulness of the breath and mindfulness of the body. And now we're going to move on. And before I do the next set of teachings and instructions, I would like us to start with a meditation. So, make yourself comfortable, but alert, upright. Just quietly close your eyes. And then one way of practicing mindfulness is just to jump right in and just notice what's going on without any preliminaries. And the jumping right in for now is check in with yourself to see how you're feeling. What's the emotional state, the mood, the mental state that's most pronounced for you? It might be very subtle. You might be calm or agitated. You might be happy or sad. You might be worried or contented. You might be lethargic or resistant. You might be enthusiastic, curious. See if you can notice the basic feeling state that you're in, emotional state you're in. And there's always one, though it might be very subtle. And then as you feel that state, Where in your body does it most clearly manifest itself? Is it mostly something in your torso or in your head? What's the physical basis for having this emotional state or feeling? The felt sense of it in the body. And then as you feel it in the body, clearly acknowledge its presence. Really kind of, and give it permission to be there. So you wouldn't be trying to get rid of it or judge it as it shouldn't be there. But as it has complete permission to be there as it is, just feel it and allow it to be there. Acknowledging its presence. And then as you feel it in your body, the felt sense of it, does it shift at all? Does it change in any kind of way? If it disappears as you're there for it, notice if it's replaced by some other emotional state or mood. And give that permission to be there. It might be interesting to very quietly whisper in the mind, name the emotional state you have. Letting go of that way of paying attention. Take a few long, slow, deep breaths now. As you breathe deep into your torso, deep into your belly, feel the torso and the belly expand. And then as you exhale, relax, let go, settle into your body. Breathing in deeply, letting go of your thoughts and concerns in favor of being here in this body. And letting your breath return to normal. There's no special way to be breathing, just whatever way seems easiest. And then almost as if you're listening, perhaps, or sensing your way into your body, be present for your body as it is. Let it reveal itself, your body, a global sense of being in a body. And then within the body, as part of the body, becoming aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences the breathing. feeling or experiencing each inhalation and each exhalation, letting the breathing process calm your mind as you breathe. Let the breathing process in its own way begin to relax your body by staying present for the breath. Might be helpful to very quietly, soft whisper in the mind, to label the in-breath in, the out-breath out, mostly as a way of nudging yourself to stay there with the breath, so that rather than having your mind wander away in thought. If the mind wanders away from the breath and you notice it, then just gently, without any comment, just begin again with your breathing. It doesn't really matter how many times your mind wanders away. What's important is that when you notice that, that you reestablish the connection with your breathing. And then attempt to hang in there with the breaths, one breath after the other. Perhaps getting a sense of the rhythm of breathing in and out. See if you can get a little sense of what it's like to engage your awareness, to be present for the breathing. It's kind of an activity of the mind to direct the attention towards the breath, to engage it, to connect the awareness to the breath, to use the awareness to take in the breathing. Calm, relaxed awareness of breath. And then if compelling body sensations arise as you're sitting here, you can let go of the breath. And then take that awareness, that mindfulness, and engage it with those body sensations. Calm, relaxed awareness directed toward those body sensations. Feeling it, sensing it, allowing it to be there, and relying just on your ability to pay careful attention. And now let your calm, deliberate awareness notice again how you're feeling, the emotional state, the mood you're in, or the mental state. Feel it directly as you can. It might be very subtle now. Or maybe you're maybe not so subtle. It could be more calm or more impatient. Could be more contented or more restless, whatever it is. And feel it in the body, the felt sense of that emotional state. Let the body be the bodily expression of it, manifestation of it. Be what you notice, where you put your attention. And whatever you're feeling for the next short while, see if you can let have permission to be there. It's completely okay. No need to do anything about it or judge it, or just let it be. But while you let it be clearly aware of it. Acknowledge it perhaps with a very quiet label and naming it what it is, as a way of staying present for it. And then in the last minute of the sitting, stay still, stay still, stay with your eyes closed, but let go of any effort at all except letting yourself breathe. Let yourself be breathed for the last minute here. So Buddhists tend to think that awareness is one of the great treasures that we have. It's one of the precious resources of human beings. And it's really a wonderful adventure to start discovering qualities and nature of awareness and how to use it and apply it. And in developing mindfulness, one of the things we're trying to do is learn how to bring mindfulness or awareness to everything that occurs, to all our experiences. So there's nothing outside. In a sense, what's most sacred in Buddhism is that awareness which has no outside, the awareness that excludes nothing, includes everything. Everything's allowed to exist within it. So when we do the mindfulness practice, we don't want to set up some kind of artificial barriers between what's acceptable for awareness, what we should be paying attention to, and other things that are happening, or some idea that some things are unacceptable for awareness. Everything can be included as part of the meditation practice. So learning kind of this inclusive nature is part of the art of this kind of meditation practice. Part of that art then is learning how to be mindful of emotions. And understanding how to include emotions, all emotions, as part of the field of practice. No emotion is unacceptable or wrong to experience in meditation itself. So some people find it very liberating that this is one place in life where there's no social conventions or rules or expectations or judgments that says, oh, this is unacceptable, you can't be this way, or you have to be a certain way. If you sit down to meditate, you're allowed to feel whatever you're feeling. You can feel murderous rage. And as long as you're sitting quietly still, you know, with your hands in your lap quietly, with nothing in it and not running after your neighbor or something, as long as you're sitting quietly, it's fine to experience whatever. So there's kind of a radical kind of acceptance of our experience, our emotional life in particular, in this meditation practice. Some people find that very liberating because of all the different ways in which they don't want to see something, they don't want to admit it. I was the kind of person who didn't want to admit that I was angry when I started a meditation practice. It wasn't in my self-image that I was an angry person. So I didn't, of course I wasn't angry then, as far as I could tell. You know, I looked around, I couldn't see it. And it took me some time through mindfulness practice to realize that actually I carried anger with me, and I just was not looking there, wasn't paying attention there because I was blocking that off. So part of the mindfulness practice is opening up the awareness so that things we're not including now can be included. And included in a generous way, an accepting way, so we're not pushing it away or denying it or fighting or struggling with it. Part of the end result of doing Buddhist practice, or this kind of mindfulness practice, is coming to a place where we're no longer in conflict with anything. to be in an unconflicted state. And so to be in an unconflicted state with your emotional life is a huge undertaking for a lot of people. So part of what I'll be talking about today is how to bring awareness to our emotions and how to include them as part of the practice instead of, you know, ignoring them or having them bug you or have them get in the way of the meditation practice as you're doing it. There's one, there's a parable or simile or a little story that the Buddha told that I think is helpful here. It's called the simile of the two arrows. And as the story goes, he was teaching some of his students, and he asked them, if a person comes along and strikes another person with an arrow, is that person who is struck by the arrow, does that person experience pain? Does that hurt? Assuming it just doesn't bounce off lightly, you know, it strikes him. And his students tell the Buddha, oh yeah, that would be painful. And then he says, he asks them, and if the archer came along and struck and hit the second arrow and struck the man a second time, would that be even more painful? That hurt more? Would that hurt again? And they said, oh yes, that would hurt again. That hurt more. And then the Buddha said, basically he said something like, the first arrow is what life gives you, which is out of your control, just things that happen. The second arrow is your reaction to what's happened. So if I'm walking down the sidewalk and I stub my toe, it's painful. That's the first arrow. If then I get angry with myself and say, Gil, you're a no good, lousy klutz. You don't know how to walk right. You should be embarrassed about yourself. Maybe you shouldn't even show your walking abilities in public ever again. And, you know, it's just kind of building up, you know, second arrows, third arrows, fourth arrows. And it's not really necessary to do that, but it's kind of this added level of suffering that I add to my experience. And so many of us, it isn't just two arrows, you know, second arrow, but we often add a third or fourth or fifth, you know. And, you know, by our judgments and evaluations and our reactions to what goes on. So I'm walking down the sidewalk, I stub my toe. I say, Gil, you're a klutz. How could you? That's the second arrow. And then I'm embarrassed because I'm a meditation teacher. I should know better than doing that to myself. And so now I'm embarrassed, which is the third arrow. And now I'm angry with myself for being embarrassed. And that's the, you know, the fourth arrow. And then I'm angry at Buddhism for not teaching me meditation practice better, how to be more mindful, more, in a better way. I should have, you know, it's Buddhism's fault, not my fault. And that's, you know, and so the arrows keep going, right? And sometimes we live in these many, many chain reactions from what the primary thing was. But the mindfulness practice is hopefully learning to kind of rest with the first arrow, if that's what's happening, if some discomfort has happened, and learn not to add more arrows, more complications. So in relationship to our emotions, it's a little bit more complex, but the simple teaching is that we try to have uncomplicated emotions. We try not to have second arrows with our emotions. We try to let the emotions be as it is. So if you're feeling like grief is one people feel, and say you've been grieving someone's loss for 6 months, and then you have this idea, I should be over it by now. Someone who's really good at grieving, they should be finished in 3 months and be on with their life, and here I'm still grieving, and I'm a grieving klutz. Now, that's really painful, I would think. And some of you might be grieving here tonight. You're just imagining yourself saying that, you know, just it's probably like salt in a wound. And so but those kinds of voices sometimes come up. But instead, what we try to do here is the grief is there, just let it be there in awareness, with trying not to have any second arrows. So what we're trying to do in the mindfulness practice, and it's not so easy to do, is to let what's happening in the present moment be there as it is without complicating it. So I like to say we give complete permission for emotions to be there as it is. There's no need for it to judge it or say it shouldn't be there. Just let it be there. Part of the reason we do this is that we're cultivating this sacred awareness, this awareness that excludes nothing, just allows things to be there. That itself is very powerful and really a wonderful thing to learn. That ability to hold things in awareness without being reactive is a real key to wise living. And many of us tend to have an experience and then we react right away. And we often make mistakes and cause more suffering. But to have the ability to hold something in awareness without needing to, in an accepting way, is one of the keys then to not reacting, but instead then having the learning, having the gap, the space, to then respond wisely as we need to. That's a very important premise or foundation for this kind of practice. The other benefit of just letting something alone, like an emotion alone, is that what Buddhism teaches, and I believe it's true, it's my experience, is that human life, the inner life, the mind, mental activities, mental life, the heart life, the emotions, the whole psycho-human being, psycho-physical human being, is considered in Buddhism to be an activity and not a thing. If it's a thing, then it's solid and unchanging in some way. But if it's an activity, then it's in flux, it's moving. And so the inner life is an activity that wants to flow, wants to move, unless we somehow seize it up, freeze it. So like resentment is frozen anger. And there's a lot of ways in which we kind of jump and hold on to our emotional life by, you know, we get attached, we resist, we do the various things that somehow locks it in place. But if we don't do that, if we simply accept it and allow it to be, it has a nature to want to move, to be an activity, and to be in flux, and to process itself, to unravel, to unfold, to resolve itself, much more than we tend to realize, give it credit for. So as we learn to kind of leave these things alone, then we allow some deeper inner psychic process to unravel or move or process itself. You know, the word emotion has the word motion in it, right? Emotion, motion. Have you ever thought about that? And then the word e is the Latin word for out, a prefix for out. So moving out. That's what emotion, the word emotion literally means in kind of Latin is moving out. It points to the process, the activity nature of emotions. But we often, like I know sometimes I'll feel, you know, a little bit sad or depressed or something and say, oh, this is it. You know, I know it's not that way forever. But, you know, somehow the kind of the unconscious almost assumption, oh, this is it. I'm going to be this way forever. And that's kind of thinking of it as a thing which is there, not an activity that wants to move and process. We tend to be a society of fixers. And we want to kind of fix and manipulate. And we have judgments about things shouldn't be this way because they should be differently. And, you know, we should, you know, we have all this medicine, these, you know, medicine and television commercials that tell us that we instant fix and we should change it. And if things are uncomfortable or bad or whatever, we should always fix things and change things and make it better or run away or avoid it. Or there's a wonderful cartoon by Charlie Brown, Charlie is talking to Linus and he says, oh, you don't think my father knows how to repair his cars? He's really good. Well, just the other day, we had this loud clanking noise coming from the car when we were driving. And Linus says, oh, don't tell me he stopped and fixed it. Oh, no, he just turned the radio up louder. So that's another way of kind of avoiding, you know, really being present for these things and sometimes locking them in. But there's a really marvelous process that can happen at times if we just hold things in awareness, kind of trust awareness, trust the mindfulness, and we don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to fix it. We just let it be in awareness and let it process. So I asked some of you this evening at the beginning and the end of the meditation to tune into how you're feeling, your emotional state. What happened to some of you when you did that? Did any of you have any emotional mood or state? And what happened when you noticed it? Yes.
What happened? I was feeling sort of a contented excitement, I guess I would say, like, and I was trying to figure out, well, where is that in my body? That was such an interesting question, and it seemed like it was a feeling of sort of a physical sensation in my stomach, kind of like not exactly butterflies, but kind of just a. And then I just sat with that physical feeling, and that was sort of strange to take that sense of an emotional idea or a sense of something and say, well, where is it? And then to feel it as a physical entity. And it pretty much stayed that way. Then I started feeling other physical things, but it was a very intriguing question.
Great. It's been said by Western psychologists that every emotion will have a physical manifestation or side to it. If you didn't have a physical kind of expression or side to it, you wouldn't know what emotion it was. So it's very interesting and very valuable for the mindfulness practice, we'll talk about in a little bit, to tune into that physical aspect of the emotional life. Most of us, what we tend to tune into with emotions is the stories about the emotion. And the stories about the emotions may or may not be true, but often they're not very useful in terms of this process we're talking about tonight. So I'll talk in a few minutes more about that. So are there little reports about what it was like to tune into your emotions? Were any of you surprised at what you noticed? Yeah?
Well, actually, for me it was kind of interesting because very quickly I was able to establish what my primary emotion was. And then in doing that, I really was able to experience what that felt like independent of what was causing it.
Mm.
And I had never done that. So in my situation, it was hopeful. It was feeling hopeful. And so I just was able to just put aside what was causing that and enjoy the feeling because hope is kind of positive. So
okay.
And it's not always going to be like that, but in this instance it was. And I was able to really enjoy what it felt like to be hopeful and just
great. So appreciating being in the immediacy of the experience rather than thinking about or remembering the story about what caused it. So the story is already gone, but the immediacy of what's actually happening now is in some ways much more rich and valuable. Stories are a little bit like virtual reality. And so there's something more, much more precious in the present moment available. That was really valuable to make that distinction. And learning to make that distinction is a very valuable part of mindfulness practice. There are certain emotions or reactions that we can have where it's really important to turn away from the object, in a sense, and really feel a subjective experience. Like, for example, strong desire or strong anger or hate or fear. We tend to very much have an object of the desire or the hate or the fear. And as long as we're locked into the object, then we're kind of in the story with the ideas and it's maybe not so useful. But if you turn the attention 180 degrees, right, around, and not to get rid of it, not to push think it's bad or wrong, but stop paying attention to the object and pay attention to what it feels like for yourself, that's where you'll start letting this inner process begin to move and unfold, and how you'll learn how to find your freedom in that situation much more quickly than if you kind of stay locked into the object.
Can I just ask you a question? How did you cellularly feel hopeful? I mean, because it was such an intriguing question to me to think of where did I feel it in my body? I'm just wondering how would you describe that in your body? How did it seem in your body being in that state? Or
cellular?
Like, how did you feel that?
In your body.
In my chest. So you felt the warmth there or something? Well, a bit of a saturation in that area.
What's interesting about the connection between emotions and the physical manifestation of it or side of it is that some people, for various reasons, maybe because they had trauma in their life, have shut off certain emotions. They don't want to feel it or see it or be with it. But because of that, because of a strong connection between the body and the emotion, if you shut out certain emotions, we tend to numb certain parts of our body. And so some people are not very much present below their neck or below their waist or something because they've kind of shut something out. And as those parts of the body reawaken, it sometimes also reawakens certain emotional, sometimes difficult emotions might surface. But more importantly is that a capacity to feel certain emotions, that capacity is a beautiful thing. And so that gets reawakened or reborn. Yes?
Speaking on the neck down part, I'm having a hard time relating to the two people that have just spoken simply because I sort of felt like I was feeling anxiety. Where was it? It was in my head. It was a thought. I was feeling anxious, and I felt bad about feeling anxious, and then I felt sort of annoyed, and then I was like off thinking about something else, and then dropped the breath, and then blah, blah, blah. And it was definitely all here. I'm like, oh, my arms feel like my arms, and my legs just feel like my legs.
Great.
It was kind of...
You know that your head is part of your body.
Yeah, I know. I know. It felt like a thought. It didn't feel...
Okay.
Didn't feel, I don't know.
There's no reason to feel bad about what you experienced, but probably as you get into this practice more, start paying attention, get more sensitive, you probably start noticing maybe it is all in your head, but you start feeling pressure or tension, or a lot of agitated energy moving around very quickly or bouncing around. You probably feel something physical, and it's for some people it's a training. It takes a while to kind of get a sense what this means or how to feel it because it's so foreign. And we live so much in our thoughts that we tend to go almost automatically into the thoughts. That's what life is all about. So it's kind of retraining that goes on. Yes, back.
I had a real nice day today, so I felt immediate sense of well-being. And when you started asking us to localize it, I was sure that I wouldn't be able to, because and then it was, I clearly felt it in my chest, but I couldn't. I could localize it, but I had no sense of describing it. I couldn't say it was lightness or tinglingness or anything. But it definitely was localizable, but not sort of. I couldn't describe it. I could locate it, but not describe it. And that felt kind of strange.
I often associate particular emotions with particular parts of me. So anger is clenching my jaws. Or sadness.
it's helpful to have an accurate reading of what goes on. Yeah.
I have a question. When you say you're in this story, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I will. Yeah. Okay. So the basic kind of idea in this mindfulness practice, in mindfulness meditation, is we stay with the breath. We kind of give some kind of special priority to the breath. We kind of hang in there with the breath the best we can. But we're ready to leave the breath also quite readily if something else arises in our experience that's more compelling than the breath. If there are things that are in the background of attention, you can stay with your breath. In the background of awareness, there are other feelings or sensations or thoughts or whatever. Just let it be in the background. You don't have to bother with it if you can keep the breath in the foreground. But if something pushes itself in the foreground, so it's competing with the breath or more compelling than the breath, then you can let go of the breath and take that other thing up as the place where your attention goes, where you pay attention to. And so if it's strong physical sensations in your body, pleasant or unpleasant, or sounds, then that can be included as part of the meditation. It doesn't have to be excluded. Just that's where we develop our mindfulness. If a compelling emotion arises, then we let go of the breath and we bring our attention to the emotion. We note the emotion we're present for that. And there's several, you know, and one of the first things you want to try to do is be very accepting of it. Now, you might not be accepting of it. You might have a second and third and fourth arrow. Now, if you're sitting here and you're feeling, what's a good emotion? Maybe you're feeling angry, right? And you're sitting there feeling angry, and then you're angry with yourself for being angry. That's a second arrow. And then you've heard the instruction, you're supposed to just accept your anger. But you can't do it. You've been angry with your anger. So this makes you really, you know, more angry, kind of a third or fourth level of anger, because you're angry with yourself for being angry at your anger. And then so it goes for a while. It doesn't really matter at what point you practice acceptance. It might be at the 105th arrow. But at some point, you can just kind of, okay, this is what I accept is here. So you might be reactive to your emotions. You might have all kinds of judgments and stuff that are kind of complications. But you just do that until you become more deeply your mindfulness has matured more. The mind does that. The mind will have these kind of reactions and judgments and to it. Be very accepting of your non-acceptance. That's what I'm trying to say here. So don't set up some kind of standard to judge yourself more, to add more arrows. Does that make sense? So, but what we're aiming for, in a sense, is to have this, to be very accepting of it. That's kind of the approach. One of the ways to be very accepting, oddly enough, is to be accepting of your non-acceptance of it. So you would try to be accepting of where it makes sense to be accepting of. It might be make sense to be most accepting of 105th arrow. If you try to do it sooner, you can't do it. Your mind, you're not ready for that. You just act automatically. So when you notice a compelling emotion, you want to just notice it's there and then kind of be very accepting of it, open to it, receptive to it. And that's a whole, sometimes a great challenge in and of itself. The second thing you would like that's useful to do is to recognize or identify what it is. And sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it's not so obvious what it is. Some people have a great emotional literacy and some people are emotionally illiterate for various reasons. And so sometimes it takes a while to develop a vocabulary of emotions and learn how to pay attention to it and tune into it. And it's a wonderful endeavor. It could take months and years, and it's well worth the time it takes to be engaged in discovering how to be present for emotions and learn the vocabulary of them. But to identify what it is. Oh, this is what, and if you're not sure what it is, then don't analyze and judge and second guess. Then you can just recognize, I'm having an emotion. But if it's something obvious, some sadness, happiness, anger, joy, love, fear, whatever it might be.
Question.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a paradox because on the one hand, labeling it, I can see the undesirability of labeling. It takes you outside the experience and may be inaccurate, not the thing itself. On the other hand, what you're saying is to try to be aware in such a way that you can say this is what this is.
Right.
Could you just address that? I mean, I know there's some differentiation here, but I
right. Right. If we're involved in complicated analysis, wondering what is this? Could it be this? Could it be that? And trying to stretch our memories and so remember there was a word back there, is it ire or is it wrath or is it irritation or is it what exactly is the right that's getting too analytical, too conceptual, too cognitive. So mostly what we're looking for is something that's really obvious. And if it's not obvious, then don't worry about it. You can just recognize you're having a feeling. It's a feeling. That's enough. So that's the main principle. But labeling, what we call labeling in our tradition, or sometimes called mental noting, can be very helpful. It does a number, has a number, and we do a lot of that. You don't have, it's an optional part of our practice. Some people don't like to do it. But I'd recommend you to try it out. The mind wants to think a lot. So we're kind of doing Aikido with the mind, where you kind of use the mind's ability to think to have the simplest possible thought you can have. And you're naming the experience you're trying to pay attention to. An idle mind will get in trouble. So if your mind is idle, the thinking will tend to carry you away. But if you use a very subtle, quiet, innocent, primitive thinking part of the mind that just identifies what something is, it can actually nudge and encourage your mind to stay present for where you want to be present. Can actually encourage you to be more intimate and more immediate with the experience rather than taking you away. And actually keeps you more on track with the experience. So we often do a lot of that in this practice. With emotions, there's an added benefit. If you name the emotion you're having, sometimes it takes some of the unhealthy power away from that emotion. In the ancient fairy tales, they talk about if you name the dragon loses its power. Or traditional cultures where you don't tell someone your birth name because then there's some idea that they have power over you. But that speaks to this idea that if sometimes you can name an emotion, it loses some of its power. And the power that the emotion sometimes will have is a power from the way in which we identify with it. We've identified with it, we're caught by it, we're engaged with it, we're believing it. And by taking this very quiet, hopefully quiet, calm part of the mind that can identify, can name the experience, the naming happens from a different part of the mind than part of the mind that's lost in the emotion, that's entangled with it. So we're stepping outside of the game of the emotion, the entanglement, from this place of a little bit more freedom or distance or clarity. And strengthening that part of the mind is very helpful for this process of finding ourselves to be more free. Does that make some sense? Is it okay?
Yes.
Is it an answer? Yes.
When I meditate, I don't usually, I'm not in a very emotional state when I'm meditating.
Right.
I'm emotional all the time. I'm reacting to what's happening.
Yeah.
When I'm meditating, I'm not reacting to things usually. It's mostly trying to control your breath and whatever. So how do you, when you are in a state where you're emotional, how do you practice the mindfulness? Because I'm not meditating at that point.
Oh, in normal life, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, great. It's a good question. So some of the same principles can apply that I'm going through here. One is to recognize that it's happening and that maybe it needs some attention. So if you're furious with someone, maybe it's more useful to kind of be quiet for a moment and really pay attention to your fury than it is to yell at them. Probably you can yell at them in 5 minutes, you know. So you can probably wait a little bit if need be. But you hang out for a little bit, so pay attention. So first recognize it's happening, and then stop and pay attention to it a little bit. It might be useful to name it. Naming it is a very quiet thing in the mind. Sometimes naming something in the mind, it seems like a silly thing to do maybe, but there's a kind of admitting that it's there. That sometimes it's kind of like a confession or admission or something. And that clear acknowledgement of something is really helpful for the psyche. Or maybe another way of saying it, if you know when someone's been really present for you and really acknowledge that they've heard you and seen you, how helpful that is. Like they repeat back to you what you said, and say, "Oh, they really heard me." Sometimes in the mind, if you name the experience, seemingly it's like the psyche feels like it's been heard or seen. So you can name it. It can be helpful. The other thing that it can be helpful with is then to feel it in your body. This is really helpful. And this is one. This is meditation also. So first we accept it if we can. And then we try to name it if we can. Some simple, very simple process. And then the next thing to do is to feel it in your body. And the body, bodily experience of an emotion is always happening in the present time. Because where else would it happen? You know? But the story we have about the emotion probably isn't about what's happening in the present. And so it's kind of like, you know, imagined reality or virtual reality. It's like past or imagined future, whatever. And sometimes emotions get continued through time, get fueled by how we engage in the story. What? He said that? How could he have said that? Well, next time I see him, I'm going to say this. But if he says that in return, then, you know. And, you know, and then one of the most dramatic stories like this of how we kind of, you know, give birth and maintain painful emotion sometimes, was on retreat once. I was teaching a long retreat, and there was a woman who came on the retreat. Had come on a lot of meditation retreats. She'd been a long time meditation student, but she had a very traumatic life, very traumatic childhood and stuff. And it was very difficult for her. She was very courageously trying to deal with her conditions and conditioning and her psychology. But she was someone who kind of always saw herself kind of in a victim situation and always saw life as being very difficult and painful and kind of tended to see the glasses half empty all the time. And she always came to talk about how difficult things were, and she was always so, you know, depressed and upset about things. And but one day she came to me after a meditation, right after, to have an interview with me, to talk to me, right after having a really amazing meditation session. And she was completely cooled out, peaceful, calm, happy. She came into the room and she was radiant. And we sat together in silence for a while because it was just, what can you say when someone's that state? And then we can kind of acknowledge that it was one wonderful place she was in. And she said, "Yeah, this is really great. This is really great." And then she said, "But yesterday I wasn't feeling this way. Yesterday I was feeling X, Y, and Z. And yesterday I was feeling yesterday." And within 2 minutes, she was worked herself up into the state again. You know, where was it? You know, she had pulled out of her memory. And based on her memory, was having all these emotions. She was pulling a story out. And then based on the story, was having all these more emotions. The body is not a story. So if we're involved in the story, we tend not to be so present in the present moment. What we're trying to do in mindfulness is to really be with the immediacy of what's happening now in our lived life. And so it's very helpful to disengage ourselves to some degree with the storyline of what's happening. Put it aside for now. You can think about stories later. But try to be in the immediacy of how you're actually experiencing it. And it turns out that part of that, very important aspect of that, is the physical aspect, the physical body part. And part of the advantage of feeling your emotions in your body is that some emotions which are difficult to experience if we stay in the story or stay with our reactions and our judgments and our fears about them are a lot easier to stay present for if we feel them in our body. A friend of mine who had a lot of fear went on a meditation retreat and his fear, I think his panic started to come. I mean, he was kind of, you know, kind of working with it. It was very difficult. And then one day in the retreat, he realized, wait a minute, fear is just a lot of intense sensations in my chest. I can be present for intense sensations in my chest. And he was. And from that day on, he had a much better ability to be present for his fear because he learned how to connect to something that he could be aware of. It's kind of like letting the body be the container that holds the experience, because that's a much better holder, container for our emotional life than our stories. The stories are actually quite fragile and not very, you know, sometimes not even accurate. So like fear is, not all fear, but sometimes there's some kind of fear that can be present a lot that has to do with anticipating what's going to happen. And we're planning, we're worried about the future. And if I could tell you, if I could get a dollar for every time I worried about the future that never arrived, I would be very wealthy. And after a while, seeing it that many times, wait a minute, I keep worrying about this thing that's going to happen tomorrow, and it doesn't happen that way. What a waste of energy. All that time yesterday worrying about something that didn't happen. And the statistics were that the great majority of the time I was worrying about something that didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen. So what a waste of energy. Right? I was caught up in the story based on the worry. So in meditation, there's a lot more I could say about daily life, but those are three simple ideas. Recognize it's happening, stop, give it space. Identify it, accept it, and then feel it in your body. And notice what happens when you feel it in the body. Another advantage of being in the body is that, well, the story tends to keep emotions kind of frozen or keeps fueling it. The bodily experience doesn't keep fueling the emotion, but rather lets it kind of unfold and unravel in the way that it wants to. And so if we want to let the emotions be processed and move and heal themselves and move into a healthy direction, feeling it in their body is one of the strongest, one of the quickest ways to do that. I think it was Carl Jung, maybe, who said the dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Is that right? To paraphrase Buddhism, or paraphrase that in Buddhist terms, the body is the royal road to the unconscious. The body is a phenomenal ally for the process of deep spiritual life into the unconscious or subconscious or this processing and stuff going on. So to drop into your body and feel it there is really an amazing thing. So you might try that, you know, as you do this meditation practice. So don't go looking for emotions. If you don't have a lot of emotions in meditation, don't worry about it. But sooner or later they'll come in some way or other. It might not be difficult emotions that come. Sometimes there's a really powerful, enjoyable emotions that come in meditation. And you treat them the same way as you would difficult emotions. You accept them, you recognize where they are, you feel them in the body, and you kind of be with them in a very kind of open way. Sometimes with very pleasant emotions, people want to hold on to them and hang on to them. And that's the second arrow. Right there. And then people say, what's wrong with holding on to something that's pleasant? It's like it hurts. It doesn't really work, and you tend to suffer more because of it. So to name the emotion is helpful. To feel it in the body is helpful. To just recognize that it's there, to stop and hold it in awareness, to be present for it as it actually is. To try to see the story making going on when it's going on. You might not be able to stop the story making. But at least you know the principle of, that's story making. And what I'm experiencing is this. is in the body here. And so you start teasing apart the story part of the thoughts from the experience, the immediacy of your experience. We're constantly looking for in mindfulness the how to be in the immediacy of our lived experience. That's really the key. Next week, I'll talk to you about how to do this with thinking. But so thoughts are can be. You can do this also with thinking. Thinking is not the enemy of this practice. But for now, I'd encourage you, let go of your thoughts as best you can. It's almost you can have the kind of attitude that when you meditate, there's nothing you need to think about. Nothing whatsoever. Unless your house is burning, then maybe you should think about that. Maybe you've never been in a situation in life where it was really clear that you didn't need to think. There's nothing you need to solve or figure out or remember or plan or nothing you have to. You will anyway. But you don't have to. And so because you don't have to, it might be a little bit easier to begin letting go of the grip we have around our thinking, our story making that we do. Yes?
I'm trying to understand a little bit about the first and the second arrow and the difference between thoughts and feelings. As I've been observing myself lately, I noticed that often the emotion comes after I've interpreted something, which I think is a thinking process. So I think often the second arrow for me, well, I think I'm beginning to see it, so it's not happening as often, but it's, you know, something happens, there's a feeling, and then I want to start interpreting that. Like you stub your toes, so you're feeling angry, and then an interpretation of the feeling of anger and stubbing a toe. It's like it's that interpretation of what happened that then creates a second arrow. What I'm noticing is if I'm noticing the interpretation, I don't think I'm not getting the second arrow because it's sort of like I'm seeing the thought before I've allowed it to manifest. And so it is like another arrow, but it's just the thought.
Right. So that's what we'll talk about next week is how to bring awareness to thoughts like that, just like what you did, and how to find freedom by doing that. But one of the fascinating things that we discover as we start paying attention more carefully is the wonderful interplay between the body and the mind, thoughts and emotions, for example. And sometimes the emotion will appear somehow first, and the mind will interpret or think or have a story about it. And sometimes some story or interpretation will arise first, and that triggers an emotional response in the body. It tends to be in Buddhism a distinction. It's not it's kind of implied in Buddhism between what's called reactive emotions and maybe what could be called innate emotions. A number of emotions are reactive. So, for example, if someone walks in through the door now and tells me, "Oh, Gil, you just won the California lottery." Now, those words by themselves are not happiness. You know, they're just words, right? But because I'm from California, I know a little bit what that means. And because I know what it means, I know how to interpret that. And so that interpretation then gives me a story. It's, wow. That means I can build a swimming pool in my backyard. That's really what I want, these hot California summers. And so I think about swimming pools, and then I start feeling happy, swimming pools. Ah, oh, isn't that great? And then my mind goes on thinking about that for a while, and then the person says, "Oh, by the way, you won the California lottery, but it was a $5 prize." And then I say, "Well, okay." So I'm disappointed a little bit. But then I interpret that by saying, "Oh, I've shown how happy I am and these wonderful dreams I have at a swimming pool to all these people here. How embarrassing." And then I feel despondent because of the interpretation of how you're going to judge me because what, right? So it's reactive. Some emotions arise reactively. Some emotions don't arrive reactively. They just kind of arise more innately. They're kind of in the system. And generally, the innate emotions are what, in English, we tend to call the positive emotions. And there's not a one-to-one correspondence here. Not all happiness is innate. Like, it's not the happiness of winning the lottery is not necessarily a good kind of happiness. But there's experiences like love and compassion, peace, certain kinds of joy and happiness and bliss that seemingly are not rising because of how we're reacting to anything externally. They are rising kind of out of the system because of how things are, not because we're engaged or interpreting or making stories or something about what's happening. And as we discover how to leave things alone and just be mindful of things, it tends to also open up the door to allow for these more innate emotions to come be more part of ourselves. So Buddhist practice is not supposed to lead us to be emotionally flat. It actually kind of tends to enrich in our emotional life at the same time as we find that we're not led around by the nose, by the emotions. They're not in charge. Because we learn how to have some freedom with them when they're arising. So is that making sense? Does anybody doesn't make this? Anybody this doesn't make sense to what I'm saying?
I have a question.
Yeah.
The business, that little Charlie Brown story about having introduce something else in order to overshadow something that exists. Is there something wrong with doing that? Or is because I do that actually quite often, and I do it. It's kind of like I use what you just talked about as a way to do that. And it happened exactly today. I was feeling very emotional about work, and truly tied to just the workload, and I was just sort of feeling inadequate and not able to get this all done. And in order to not break down in tears in front of my boss, I thought about my daughter and how lucky I was. I mean, I would just totally transpose myself to another place while crying, just so I could think of something happy,
sure,
and calm and peaceful, so I could push that away.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure.
I'm
reluctant to judge these things kind of categorically as right or wrong, good or bad, these kinds of things. At times, these kinds of strategies are wise, and sometimes they're not so wise, not useful. And sometimes other strategies are more useful. I'm sure there are times in life where it's very useful to distract oneself or to use an antidote or do something like that. And with some bosses, they might fire you if you cry because, you know, it's too difficult, whatever. And so you need to do whatever you can do to keep your job, right? And some bosses might actually be so compassionate that you actually losing a great opportunity. And maybe if you cried, they would have, wow, let's sit down and talk about this. Maybe. So you have to know your boss. But what happened...
Somewhat manipulative, though. I want to deal with it. I want to deal with it the best way that for me to... And I didn't mean to be
right.
Insulting by that. I want to deal with it the best way for me to deal. You know, I want to learn to control my emotions, and because I am kind of emotional
right.
In that respect. So I don't think it was appropriate for me to become tearful or weepy there.
I can well imagine that. And however, if a person's always distracting themselves from what they're really feeling as a strategy and never paying attention to certain things, then we're living a truncated life or a numbed life or not a full life. And some people are always running away. We have a society of people who are experts or almost experts trying to run away. People who are alcoholics sometimes, addicts of various kinds, are often sometimes trying to run away from something they don't want to look at. And people do it through television or they do it through all kinds of things. So they don't have to be present for what's actually going on. And to always be distracting is a very unhealthy way of living because some things can be living festering. So we need to have... So there might be times where it's very useful to distract ourselves, but there's also the time to sit down and really be with it and face it. And so it might be that with your boss, you don't want to show what's going on, distract yourself so you can manage. But then when you get home, maybe you want to do something quality time with yourself and then your own good time and place. Open to it and feel it directly.
Yeah. What do I do then?
You could do what you could. It's one option you have. Is you could you can go for a walk with a friend and talk about it, which is a nice thing to do with something like that. But you could also sit and meditate.
Because I think if I sit down and meditate, and that's what I thought about, because it did happen toward the end of the day, and I thought if I sit down to meditate, I think I'm going to already have an agenda for my meditation session. You know that I'm going to deal with this sort of emotional.
Huh?
No. I'm going to have a predisposition for being all emotional when I sit down and meditate. So, I don't, you know what I'm saying?
I wouldn't make it so complicated. Just sit down and just be with how you are. And if you have strong emotions that you bring with you to the meditation, then start doing emotions meditation right away. Sometimes if there's a lot of emotional reactivity going on, the mind won't settle down enough so we can see clearly, to be present. So then sometimes you might want to just forget about the emotions for a while, distract yourself maybe, and just be with the breath, get concentrated on the breath, kind of count the breath or be with the breath for a while until you've calmed down enough. And once you've kind of calmed down enough, not dramatically, but just enough, then you can start open up and experience the emotion and explore it. Maybe then it's more useful. Okay. I wanted to end with a short sitting. So make yourself comfortable, but alert. Relaxed, but upright. Letting your spine be a little bit more. This will only be about 5 minutes or so. Let your spine a little bit more upright than maybe you normally have it. Take two really deep breaths and then relax as you breathe out. And then letting your breath be as it is. Hang in there with your breathing. Just breathe. Be breathed. Let the breathing breathe you. Could be useful sometimes to imagine that the breathing, the in-breaths and out-breaths are like waves. And as the waves wash across the shore, it's like the waves of breath washing across the shore of awareness, moving up and back and forth, up and down the shore of awareness, feeling each breath coming and going. And as you sit here now, being with your breath, for the next couple of minutes, try to be very accepting of how you are. Completely accepting whatever is going on. If you're distracted or agitated or calm or relaxed or emotional or caught up in stories or restless in your body or just whatever is going on. See if you can be completely okay or accepting. And then within the middle of this field of acceptance, be aware of yourself breathing. So there is another handout for today, I think, somewhere out there on the table. If you'd like the handout with the homework, and I hope you're doing the homework. Maybe there's a better word than homework, maybe. But the exercises. And if you don't have it, don't pick one up, forget one or lose or something, we now have that homework on our website, so you can download it from there. And see what it's like this next week to include your emotions as part of your meditation practice. And some of the exercises in the handout talk about also paying attention to emotions in regular life. And you might explore that a little bit and see what that's like. And I wish you all a wonderful week. And next week we'll look at this wonderful world of thinking.